Welcome to a new episode of Software Crafts Podcast. My name is João, and I'm your host for today. And with us, we have Edzo. Edzo is an enterprise engineer with more than 15 years of experience. His belief is that enterprise engineering covers not only enterprise architecture, but also the skills needed to realistically implement innovation, governance, and architecture. This implies that group psychology, IT security architect, technology, innovation, and ethics are a few topics that should be included in developing strategy and architecture. In 2020, Edzo wrote his master title, Defining Antifragility and the Application on Organization Design, and graduated with the highest distinction. Edzo is currently working on a new version of DYA, a view in enterprise architecture. Edzo is since this year part of security, Xavier Security with specialization on resilient organization. Hi Edzo, and thanks for your time to be with us.
Hey Carl, it's nice to be here.
Cool. And jumping into the topic of today or the heuristic of today is design for constant evolution. What is your opinion and experiences around this?
That's a really big topic to start with and to talk about. What I think is that we started designing companies and systems from a blueprint design and thinking we knew it all. And we are currently in a state of mind as in the world that we accept that the world is changing nonstop and we are afflicted by a lot of change. So I think for our software and for our organizations, it's mandatory to design them to evolve nonstop. And I think the impact on this is really big. So the impact is not only on the design part of the organization, but also the consequence for the people in the organization and using the tools. So I think it's mandatory if you want to stay relevant as an organization with our organization itself and the tools within the organization.
Very interesting. And well, you start with a thing that just triggered me, that we in the past, we community or industry, did lots of blueprint design for organizations. In your experience, when did we start to acknowledge or be aware that perhaps these blueprints are not working, or are they working?
I think that's difficult to say because usually history is old colors of gray. So it's difficult to make a hard divide when that happens. Because if you look at the theory about learning organizations, about dynamic systems, about evolution, those are really old. But what I think is that our IT started from designing transistors and large computers with electrical engineering. And our field slowly evolved into personal computers and more being used in business processes. And then later on evolved to being in every device in the house. And I think there somewhere is the tipping point that we know to say it's not something that is in a big building with just a few transistors, but it's everywhere and where it involved our lives. I think there is somewhere is the tipping point that it's the need for more evolution is there because there's more connectivity. So what I, if I look at problems, questions from customers or design questions, it's good to look what are is the connectivity with other systems or with other persons. And if there is no connectivity, it's working isolated. The evolution is not needed that much as if it's connected with everything. So if your organization is going through digital transformation, everything is digital, you're connected to the internet, all your customers are can be with one click to another customer, then you are really interconnected with your people and with the other systems. And then the need for nonstop evolution is much higher than if it's isolated from everything.
It's very, very interesting that how you explain and your view and perception why now we need evolution. But now I want to challenge you if because our industry or our field is so young, if we compare for building houses. We do these for thousands of years.
We're infants. Yeah.
If we are too arrogant not to look to other industries or other solutions that people in different fields already found and can be applicable to help our organizations to design for constant evolution.
I don't know if it's ignorance or arrogance or, and I'm not certain if we have a real example of this. So for my master thesis, I studied anti-fragility and resilience, and I slowly dipped my toes into the domain of complexity science. And what I found was that the field there is really young. So the topic itself is really old. But the theories, the replication, the studies are limited, are really young compared to other fields of science. And if we look at the field of science itself, we notice that we are pretty okay in predicting a Large Hadron Collider. We can make it, and we can predict the elements that will come from a collision with high energy. So we are pretty good at calculating stuff if we look at physics. But if we look at social science or economics, we're not that good in predicting or replicating. So I think the field of nonstop evolution, where also the human behavior is in there, or the nonlinear reaction of systems, I think that field is really young. So I don't think there's arrogance or people think they understand. I think for most people I talk to understand that they don't know anything. And I think there also isn't yet a large body of knowledge that we can use. So we are in a really interesting times where we need to be careful in what we say, and we need to be careful in what we study, because we are in uncharted territories for that.
Very interesting, and thanks even for challenging my assumptions. It's very interesting to see how your mind works. And before we deep dive into complexity theory, that is a topic that I love, what is the difference between anti-fragility and resilience?
That's a nice question. Resilience for me is the... I have to recollect my thoughts, because to be precise in this, resilience is a function over time. So in the time something happens, and it's on the how a system reacts or behaves to the input of stress. So if we have a table and the stress is that we hit it with the hammer, then the how the system behaves over time. Is the value over time. That was it. So the value of the system drops if I hit it, and it goes back because it has a resilience behavior that it pops back in its original structure, an original function. So it's a value over time function, where anti-fragility states that the value will increase if you add more stress. So it's not based on the factor of time. I think there's the difference. So resilience is about responding to how it responds with the value as output. And if you want to optimize that, so you non-stop increase on value over time, then you come to anti-fragility, where it's a function for stress. And it only applies when you are in a context where there's a lot of stress, or you want to be prepared for the unexpected. So I have a lot of conversations with people if they need to make an anti-fragile software system or anti-fragile organization. And that is not always the case, because perhaps your system is a predictable or robust system, and it and you accept the vulnerabilities of an unpredicted event. Because optimizing for the unexpected has costs, and it depends on your risk appetite if you want to pay those costs. So the difference is there in the function on the dimensions and over the optimization.
thanks to clarify these concepts. And well, I'm gonna park complex theory because you said something that you have discussions with people about. Do I need to bring my software and my organization to an anti-fragile state, or resiliency just enough because I can predict? What are your heuristics to know and to give the advice to people if they need an anti-fragile or if they need a resilient organization?
It's a question with a lot of layers. Is first of all, the person who I'm talking to, does that person looks at the system, and let's use system as a generic term, as a system of systems. So does the person understand that the finance department should have a different behavior than the R&D department, or that the database with your client's personal information should have different requirements than the a beta app in the app store where no data is stored? That is usually the first the conversation we have. And the second conversation we're having is about which behavior do you want to see in resilience? So do you want to have a system that is tightly designed and can cope with a bit of stress, but will not be expected to have non-stop stress on it? And if it breaks, it's not that bad. Because if something breaks, you can throw it away. It's much cheaper to make, to produce, to uphold than a system that you need to keep alive. Keeping something alive costs a lot of money. And then if they have, and we have the conversation on that, and they recognize that the system as a whole should reconfigure based on inputs, based on stress, and then is able to create more value, they envision that, then the challenge is, are you able to let loose of control and embrace the chaos? And that's a personality type question. And that's a really difficult conversation, because if you want to design a system, so an organizational software that recuperates from a disturbance, you can design a lot. And that's a certain personality type that loves designing, loves to be in control, loves to use hierarchy. And for some cultures in organizations, that works best. But if you want to have an organization or system that reconfigures itself, finds a new purpose, and to create new value, so it defines its own new functionality, for example, and you want to let that go, so you want to have autonomy to that business unit or that team or that small DevOps team, then you should let go of the control in that aspect, because then they can grow. And if it's that not a part of the possibilities because of the company culture or the personality culture, then that type of resilience and even anti-fragility is out of the question. So those are slowly the three basic questions, talks I have with them, the challenges about how they operate, how they look at the world together.
Yeah, very, very interesting. Thanks for sharing. It's it was a curveball, indeed, and I really the way that you have the layers, I hope that gives pointers to the audience, and they can then interact with you on social media about this aspect. And now going into the complexity theory, you said that during your research for your master's, you tip your toes on complexity theory, and I also know that there are five big complexity theories, with the one that emerging in the center being known as anthrocomplexity by Dave Snowden. Are you referring to the latest works of Dave and Snowden, or the other theories that precede his work?
I only scanned the surface of those theories, and basically I used the decomposition that was provided on the Wikipedia page, and then looked at do we know about evolvable systems, or do we know about network theory, And I found a lot of contradicting papers. And then I quickly made for me the scope. This is too complex to put in part of my thesis. So what I'm currently doing is I'm starting to read into Dave Snowden, because a lot of people find him a really good authority on this topic. But I know nothing about it, so I'm slowly going into there. But I do know that people as Dave Snowden are they get a lot of different reactions from the field. So there are different professionals and different academics that have different opinions on that. And I think that is good, because that creates discussion, and from discussion we create knowledge. So that is really good.
Friction yeah. helps, right? And especially because his work, although has 21 years officially,
yeah.
It's pretty new comparing to other areas of knowledge. And it's good that there are friction and healthy discussions.
And I believe in reproduction. So I've seen a few of his lectures on YouTube about the way he does domain-driven design. And he retrieves information from a population of people and creates cohorts of mental models, so how people interpret the world. I just started early, but he's the only one I've heard talking about this or read about describing this. And if more people are talking about this and trying this within their companies, then we get a feeling about how this works and why it works. And at least in my background as enterprise architect and information analyst and business analyst, these kind of techniques were not known to me. So if you look at the business analyst body of knowledge, the BABOK, as far as I know, these kind of techniques of getting requirements from your users about what adds value for them, or how they create stakeholder groups, I have not heard of that before. So that's really interesting. And I hope that a lot of people are going to try it to falsify what he's saying or verify what he's saying.
It will be interesting times for us to observe that. It will be, and indeed more knowledge will be generated. And going back to this last part, you talk about mental models, and in the beginning you talk about a lot about people. Why mental models are so important, and what is the relation to some conflicts that we might have on the workplace, on this system of systems that we are talking about?
Well, it's again a really big question. This term, I was introduced at the Android Management School on how to work with culture, and I also found it in the work of Peter Sanch in the learning organization, the fifth discipline. And there the mental model is used as a word to describe that the reality has a lot of viewpoints. So you observe as a person reality differently from me, because we have a different height, and also because we have different experiences and are different persons. And this is for everybody. And to be able to collaborate together on a topic, we have to have a shared understanding of the topic. It should not be perfectly shared, but that we use the same language, English, with the flavor of IT, living in the Netherlands. That gives us a language to describe the topic we want to work on. Now we're working in IT, so probably also some diagrams and some programming language. And so we can collaborate. But if we needed to work together with somebody that doesn't speak English, doesn't work in the IT, is specialized as a patisserie in Paris, for example, then it's really difficult to collaborate on a topic, because we don't have a shared mental model about the topic, no matter what it is. If we're going to talk about eating, hey, then we have a shared mental model and we know what it is, and then we can collaborate. And I think that is really important, that most of the issues, and it's something in my, when I was a student, it was for me a truth, and during my working life in IT also, all problems are basically communication problems. between computers, different character sets, different file formats, but also between persons. If I look at the world from a lot of different tones of gray, and another person looks only like black and white, then we have to align our way we're looking at the world, else we cannot communicate. And if we do not align, we're getting somewhere along the line into a conflict. And usually it doesn't matter because it's communication, it's alignment. In the end, we all just want to have a cup of tea and a cuddle. So I think the shared mental model is really important. It's communication, and it's foundational to have a constructive dialogue to create stuff.
Yep, very long one. Also a deep, deep answer for a tricky question. And in this final part, you were talking about communication. That is what you have been finding. Yeah. Do you think from your work experience that inside of the enterprises, the communication is getting better or not?
I don't know. I think it's what I think is that people are getting more aware about the nuance of communication and of the power of it. So before I started working in IT, I already was fascinated by change management organizations, and their communication was really big topic. But that was within the domain of change management. I have the assumption, the idea, that most people around me know that's important, but it's also getting more difficult because we are more connected. So if I listen to the old geezers in my field, they say, yeah, we had one manager and we were architects and we said we go left and everybody went left. And those days are not there anymore. If the chief of an organization said we go left, everybody is going to discuss if you're going left or right or in the middle or how many degrees. So communication is getting more diverse and therefore difficult, but we are also getting more aware of that. So I'm not certain if we're getting better at it, but we are changing in it. That's for certain.
Very, very interesting. And in a related and follow-up question, you work with enterprise architecture and mental models and sharing. So what are your practices to share these mental models and create this common understanding if communication is there?
Basically, there are two things I always use. One is try to communicate in something that you can draw quickly on a whiteboard, because that limits your drawing space and also the complexity of your diagrams, because the nuance has no value if you're talking to a large audience or your goal is to align mental models. The details are only interesting if you are going to generate program code on it or have to calculate something. So be abstract. That's one. The second one is, but that's, I think, also because we are in the trade of IT consultants. We are guests at other companies. We have to adapt to the internal language of that company. So if I work for a bank, I will use different words and different sentences and different threats and opportunities than when I work for an aviation company or for a healthcare company. And I think that sensitivity and that willingness to adapt to the language of your context, that's really important. And that context can change, so you have to be aware of that.
So in my experience in the college, we teach about the programming languages and databases, yeah, and all of that, not about nuances. You think that this skill to be sensible, to change our language in the context, it's a easy thing to learn, or it only comes with experience?
I think it comes with experience, and that's part is working experience and part educational experience. So I went to Android management school because I wanted to learn a certain language called Demo, and that's a way to reduce, to make a summary of information. So if you have a lot of business process modeling descriptions, you have a lot of design documents, there's a lot of words and a lot of drawings that you can reduce in a small drawing to that shows essential of that organization. And I tried to learn that by books and it didn't work, so I went to there. But I had a lot of students that came from different places that wanted to increase their vocabulary and wanted to increase their mental model toolkit to have better conversations with IT or with business. We are at a consulting company, and I always advise young people to go to a different company every half a year to increase their internal mental model toolkit and their vocabulary. Because if you are for 5 years at the same company as a consultant, your vocabulary is limited, and therefore you cannot add extra value. So I think it's experience, but it's not only experience by age, but you should train yourself. You should infuse yourself with randomness and with change to increase your vocabulary. Currently I'm working for the security unit in Xabia, and we're focusing on reliability engineering. And most important thing is, if you're at a business, train yourself for unexpected events. Train yourself what happens if AWS goes down. Train yourself if your work site is not available anymore. And then everyone said, yeah, but my headquarters will always be there and the power will always be on. And then Corona came along, or there's a big strike at your public transport or whatever. So keep yourself infused with randomness to train yourself to increase your vocabulary on what you can do, how to describe things, what can happen. So I think experience itself, as really the word experience, is really important. And that can be a lot of different things.
Very interesting. And thanks for your advice for the audience that might be there out there looking for some answers on with these regards, right? Because this is also a career progression you own your career, you do your own decisions. And now you were talking about this particular one, and we were discussing this enough, that is, my headquarters is always there, or the light is always on. Where I live 6 months ago, we had problems with rats in the main station in the middle of the woods, that they just shoo all the cables. So 3 outages in a row every night.
Nice.
Power is always there, right? Do you think that practices like chaos engineering can help organizations to challenge the mental models that they have of the world?
I think they are part of the solution. So chaos engineering needs a certain maturity level of your team and your organization to apply. So else if you're going to play with fire, you should be experienced with fire and firefighting. So not just blindly introduce fire. And I think it originated only in the software domain, hardware domain, but I think it's more than that. So, and I think if you look at old school ETL, there was something called business continuity planning in training, and you have to train to evacuate the building within time and the data center backups. I think we should look more broadly at that. So chaos engineering is a part of that spectrum. My history is in American football, and I played on a pretty high level. And I played with two teams that both became champion without defeat in their season. And the only way we achieved those goals or that level was by training really hard, but also having games against competitors we didn't know outside of our division. Because we didn't know them, we didn't know the players, they were highly motivated to win from us and to experiment. So you introduced a lot of randomness into your playing style and your play game, so that when we did the normal championship, we were prepared for the unexpected. And I think that's the same for companies. If you let people just do their day-to-day job according to the scripts, then your business will be disturbed by randomness. But if you give people the freedom to train and to be prepared, it's going to be okay.
Yeah, and circling back to the heuristic that can help with designing an organization for evolution, right? Getting these practices. And you were saying that chaos engineering can be one part of the solution. What are the other part or the other parts?
So I think the same principles, but then on a non-IT part. So letting people close down a part of your organization, or reorganizing a lot, that also helps. So I've been a bit at big companies that reorganized a lot, so every half a year. But if I talk to people that were working there for 40 years, they said, "Oh, it's just the same. Only the upper region will change, but we will be doing our job." And so they became agnostic for reorganizations. And I think that is a way how you can also look at this. Just think about what is your threat model, for which things you want to be trained, which type of factors, and then think, how can I enforce that? Can I rotate people in my team every so many weeks, months, years? Can I ask them to switch their technology every X, Y, Z periods? So I think that if you look from a business continuity of risk management or security management at your threat model, then you can identify the domains you want to improve on your resilience, and then you can introduce chaos engineering like principles in that domain.
Very interesting. Also a new view on typical reorganizations and the feelings of people, but also connecting these to resilience in this case. And with this thought, we are really close to the end of the episode. So I will like to ask you resources that you might want to suggest to the audience: books, podcasts, blog posts that can help people to deep dive into these topics. And we touch in lots of them.
I have a lot of them. I have a challenge for people. There's an author called Jan Hogevorst. And he's written the book The Foundation of Enterprise Engineering, and that's a really difficult book to read. But every sentence can gives you 15 minutes to think about. So if people think they are super smart and want a book that challenges them but also delivers a lot of content, so it's worth the effort, I would advise that book. If people are interested in the learning organization, there's a book called Rethinking the Fifth Discipline by Floor, and it addresses the viable systems model by Stafford Beer. It addresses the learning organization by Peter Sange and other really big thinkers. And Floor is able to summarize those big concepts in like 2 pages. And that's incredible, and readable pages. So where Hogevorst is difficult to read, but has a lot of value, Rethinking the Fifth Discipline delivers a lot of value and is easy to read. And that can be a way to go to different books. So Stafford Beer is interesting and Sange is interesting, but then you can start with the summary by Floor.
Okay, thanks. I will make sure that these two resources are on the description. Also your social media, so people can engage with you if they already read some of these books. Will be fun. And I want to thank you again for your time to be with us today.
Thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks. You can follow us on Twitter at @scraftspodcast. Visit our webpage, softwarecraftspodcast.com, or follow our page on LinkedIn. Hope to see you next week.